Site 7, Ilium by Dan Simmons. Continuing on page 190.
I should join you, said Savi. She sounded dubious.
I know how to handle your machine, said Odysseus, nodding toward the Sony.
I know, but... Savi touched the black weapon in her belt.
No need, said Odysseus. It's just food I'm seeking, not a war. There will be no Voynix down there.
Savi still hesitated. Odysseus looked at Ada and Harmon.
Wait here. I'll be back as soon as I get my spear and shield.
Harmon laughed before he realized that the barrel-chested man in the pale tunic was not joking. Odysseus did indeed know how to fly the Sony. They lifted off the tower top, circled the high saddle with its ruins, throwing complicated shadows in the low sunlight, and swooped down a valley at high speed.
I thought you meant you'd be hunting below the bridge, said Harmon over the wind hiss.
Odysseus shook his head. Ada noticed that the man's silver hair fell down his neck like a curly mane.
Nothing there except jaguars and chipmunks and ghosts, said Odysseus. We have to get out on the plains to find game. And there's one prey in particular that I have in mind.
They flew out of the canyon mouth and mountains at high speed and soared over high grasslands, sprinkled with towering cycads and fern-topped trees. The sun was setting but still above the mountains, and everything on the plain threw long shadows. A herd appeared below, large grazing animals that Ada could not identify, brown hides with white-striped butts. The hundreds of creatures were antelope-like in form, but each was three times an antelope's size, with long, strangely jointed legs, long flexible necks, and dangling snouts that looked like pink hoses. The Sony made no noise as it swooped over them, and none of the grazing animals even looked up.
What are they? Asked Harmon.
Edible, said Odysseus.
He circled lower and landed the Sony behind some high fern shrubs some 30 yards downwind of the grazing herd. The sun was setting. In addition to two absurdly long spears, each was almost as long as the Sony, and the butts and shafts of the spears had protruded well beyond the force field bubble and stern of the flying machine. Odysseus had brought a round shield made of intricately worked bronze and layers of oxide, as well as a short sword in a scabbard and a knife tucked into the belt of his tunic. To Ada, who had gone under the turin cloth more frequently than she had admitted to Harmon, this juxtaposition of a man from the fantastical Turin drama of Troy with her world, or this wild version of her world, made her somewhat dizzy. She rose and started to follow Odysseus and Harmon away from the landed Sony.
No, snapped Odysseus. You stay with the vehicle.
The hell I will, said Ada.
Odysseus sighed and spoke to them in a whisper.
Both of you stand here behind this bush. Don't move. If anything approaches, get in the Sony and activate the force field.
I don't know how to do that, whispered Harmon.
I left the AI active, said Odysseus. Just lie down in it and say force field on.
Carrying both spears, Odysseus went out onto the grassy plain, walking slowly and silently toward the grazing beasts. Ada could hear the floppy-nosed animals grunting and munching, could hear the grass being snapped off by their teeth, and could smell their strong scent. They did not run in alarm when the man approached, and when the animals on the edge of the herd finally looked up, Odysseus was within 40 feet. He stopped, set down one spear and his shield, and hefted the other long spear. The grazing animals had quit chewing and were watching the strange biped carefully now, but they did not seem alarmed. Odysseus' powerful body coiled, arced, and released. The spear flew flat and straight, hitting the closest animal above the chest and almost passing through its long, thick neck. It whirled, made a strangled noise, and fell heavily. The other grazers snorted, bleated, and ran hard, each animal zigging and zagging in a way Ada had never seen before. The grazer's oddly jointed legs allowing almost instant changes of direction, until the entire herd thundered out of sight down a draw a mile or so to the north. Odysseus dropped to one knee next to the dead animal and pulled the short curved knife from his belt. With a few quick strokes, he opened the abdominal cavity, pulled out organs and entrails, tossing them onto the grass except for what looked to be the liver, which he set on a small plastic tarp he had laid out next to him, and then sliced the hide back from one haunch, cutting a thick slice of red meat free and setting it on the tarp as well. Then he cut the dead animal's throat, draining more blood onto the grass, and tugged his spear free, taking care not to break it. He carefully wiped the shaft and bronze point on the grass. Still standing near the bush, Ada felt a wave of dizziness pass over her and decided to sit down on the grass rather than run the risk of fainting. Ada had never seen an animal killed by a human being, much less butchered and partially skinned so expertly. It was terribly efficient. Ashamed of her reaction but not wanting to faint, she lowered her head toward her knees until black spots quit dancing around the circle of her vision. Harmon touched her back in concern, but when she waved him away, he began walking out toward the carcass. "Stay there," called Odysseus. Harmon paused, confused. "They're gone. Do you need help carrying?" Odysseus held up one palm to keep Harmon where he was. "This isn't what I'm hunting for." "This is. Don't move." Harmon and Ada turned their faces to the west. Two white and black and red bipedal forms were approaching at very high speed, faster even than the grazers had fled. Ada felt her breath catch in her throat and saw Harmon freeze. The creatures ran toward the bloody grazer carcass and the kneeling Odysseus at more than 60 miles per hour, then skidded to a stop in a small cloud of dust. Ada saw that they were the birds they'd seen from the Sony, terror birds, Savi had called them. But what had been strangely amusing from high in the air, ostrich-like creatures strutting like awkward chicks, turned out to be, in truth, terrifying. The two terror birds had stopped 5 paces from the carcass, their eyes on Odysseus now. Each bird was more than 9 feet tall, with short white feathers on their muscular bodies, black feathers on their vestigial wings, and powerful legs as thick as Ada's torso. The birds' beaks had to be at least 4 feet long, wickedly curved red around the mouth, as if dipped in blood, and controlled by powerful jaw muscles that bulged below the half-dozen long red feathers that protruded from the back of each terror bird's skull. Their eyes were a terrible, malevolent yellow ringed by blue circles and set under saurian brows. In addition to their rending predator beaks, the birds had powerful foot claws, each as long as Ada's forearm, and an even more wicked-looking claw at the bend of each vestigial wing. Ada knew at once that this monster was no mere scavenger, but a terrible predator. Odysseus rose, a long spear in his left hand and his bloodied spear in his right hand. The terror birds' heads snapped back in unison. Yellow eyes blinked at yellow eyes, and the hunting pair moved apart like well-choreographed dancers, preparing to attack Odysseus from either side. Ada could smell the carrion reek of the monsters. She had no doubt that those powerful naked legs could propel each terror bird 20 feet or more at its prey, Odysseus, in a single hop, claws extended and ripping as the one-ton monsters landed. It was also obvious that the pair worked perfectly as a killing team. Odysseus did not wait for them to get into position or attack. With lethal grace, he cast his first spear, flat and straight and hard, into the muscled breast of the terror bird on his left, then wheeled to face the second bird. The first bird let out a terrible screech that froze Ada's lungs, but it was matched a second later by a roar and howl from Odysseus as he sprang across the grazer carcass, tossed the second killing spear from his left hand to his right, and thrust the bronze point at the second terror bird's right eye. The first bird staggered backward, clawing at the spear protruding from its chest, snapping off the thick oak shaft. The second bird dodged Odysseus' thrust by whipping its head back like a cobra's. Obviously taken by surprise by being attacked by this small featherless biped, the bird hopped twice, carrying it 10 feet backward, and clawed at the parrying spear. Odysseus had to whip the unwieldy spear back quickly after each thrust to keep from having it torn out of his hands. Still shouting, the man stepped backward and seemed to trip over the bloody grazer carcass rolling on his side. The uninjured terror bird saw its chance and took it, leaping 6 feet into the air and coming down on Odysseus with talons and killing claws extended. Still rolling, Odysseus came to one knee in a single fluid movement and planted the butt of the spear in the ground an instant before the terror bird came down on it with the full weight of its body, driving the bronze point home, up through its muscled chest into its awful heart. Odysseus had to roll again to get out of its way as the huge creature crashed, lifeless where he had been kneeling. "Look out!" cried Harmon and began running toward the fray. The first terror bird, pouring blood from the spear wound and broken shaft still embedded in his chest, was rushing at Odysseus' back. The bird's head snapped forward on 6 feet of feathered snake neck, and the huge beak snapped where Odysseus' head would have to be if he retreated. But the warrior had thrown himself forward rather than back, rolling again, but with empty hands this time as the terror bird ran past him, and then wheeled, twisting and turning almost as impossibly fast as had the oddly jointed grazers. "Hey!" shouted Harmon and threw a rock at the giant bird. The terror bird's head snapped high, the yellow eyes blinked at the impertinence, and the huge predator kicked forward toward Harmon, who skidded in the dirt, said "shit" in a high voice, and scrambled back the way he had come. Suddenly Harmon realized that he couldn't outrun the monster, and he turned, legs apart, fists raised, ready to meet the terror bird's charge with his bare hands. Ada looked around for a rock, a stick, a weapon of any sort. There was none in reach. She leaped to her feet. Odysseus swept up his shield and, using the grazer's carcass as a springboard, jumped aboard the terror bird's back, pulling his short sword from its scabbard as he did so. The bird kept running in Harmon and Ada's direction, but now its neck was twisted around, head snapping, giant red beak clacking against Odysseus' circular shield. Every time the massive jaws struck, Odysseus was knocked backward, but his legs were tight around the bird's body 6 feet above the ground, and though he bent far back like a trick horseback rider in the Turin drama, he never fell off. Then, as the terror bird's head swiveled around, finding Harmon with its yellow eyes, Odysseus leaned forward and pulled, severing the jugular. He jumped off, landed on his feet, and ran to Harmon's side as the terror bird crashed to the ground and lay still not 10 feet in front of them. Blood spurted 5 feet in the air, and then the red fountain diminished and disappeared as the huge heart stopped beating. Panting, covered with grazer gore and terror bird blood and grass and mud, his bloody sword and shield still held high, Odysseus grinned through his beard and said, "I only wanted one for dinner, but we'll carve up the second one for leftovers." Ada came up to Harmon and touched his arm. He never looked around. His eyes were wide. Odysseus walked to the nearest bird, cut off its huge head, and ran his skinning knife down the length of its chest, peeling flesh and skin and feathers back as easily as someone would help remove a thick coat. "I'll need more plastic bags," he said to Harmon and Ada. "There are some in a storage locker near the aft end of the Sony. Just say, 'open locker' to the machine and it will open, but hurry." Harmon had turned to walk back to the Sony but paused. "Hurry? Why?" Odysseus wiped blood from his beard with the back of his hand and grinned whitely at them. "These birds smell blood up to 10 leagues away, and there are hundreds of hunting pairs of terror birds out here on the plains at twilight." Harmon turned and ran hard toward the Sony to get the bags. Ada noticed that Savi and Demon were both drunk before dinner began. The meal was served in a glass room attached to the side of the South Tower's higher support. Savi was heating pre-prepared meals in a regular microwave bubble, but Ada was fascinated. She had never seen a meal prepared exclusively by a human being before. The absence of servitors in the Golden Gate residence areas was even more noticeable during a meal. Odysseus was outside on the bridge's broad support strut and had erected a clumsy stone and metal structure in which he was burning wood he'd brought back from the plains. It had begun to rain, and Odysseus had to build the fire high to keep it burning. Flames lighted the rust and faded orange paint on the side of the tower. Looking out through the translucent green wall, sipping from his glass of gin, Harmon said, "Is that some sort of altar to his pagan gods?" "Not quite," said Savi. "It's how he cooks his food." She carried bowls and plates to the round table where the others were waiting. "Call him inside, would you?" she said to Harmon. "Our food is getting cold while he's cremating his. And there's a lightning storm coming over the mountains. It's not a great idea to be out on the bridge superstructure during a lightning storm." When they were finally seated, Odysseus setting the wooden plates of steaming meat on a nearby counter so that no one would have to stare at the fire-blackened stuff. Savi passed around a pitcher of wine. She poured her own glass last, and Ada overheard the old woman whisper,
Bargatadne, Reheno Merk Haulam, Bri Pri Hagafen.
What is that? Ada asked softly. Everyone else was laughing at something Demon had said and had not seemed to notice Savi's muttering. And the only time Ada had ever heard another language was in the Turin drama. There the battling men spoke in gibberish, but somehow the Turin translated every word so that anyone under the cloth understood the meaning without actually listening. Savi shook her head, although whether to say that she did not know the meaning of the odd words or that she was not disposed to tell them, Ada could not tell. "I explored all the levels of the bridge and bubbles around the bridge," Hannah was saying excitedly. "The metal of the bridge itself is old and rusty, but amazing. And there are strange shapes of metal in some of the rooms below, just freestanding, not part of any structure. Some are in the shape of men and women." Savi barked a laugh. She was already refilling her glass with wine. No strange words accompanied this pouring.
"Those are statues," said Odysseus. "Sculptures. Have you never seen such things?"
Hannah shook her head slowly. Even though the girl had spent years learning how to heat and pour metal aid in you, the idea of making things in the shape of human beings or other living things was shocking. Ada also found it strange.
"They have no art," Savi said brusquely to Odysseus. "No sculpture, no painting, no crafts. No photography, no holography, not even genetic manipulation. No music, no dance, no ballet, no sports, and no singing. No theater, no architecture, no kabuki, no plays, no nothing. They're as creative as newborn birds. No, I take that back. Even birds know how to sing and build a nest. These latter-day Eloi are silent cuckoos, inhabiting other birds' nests without so much as a song for payment."
Savi was beginning to slur her words slightly. Odysseus looked at Hannah, Ada, Demon, and Harmon, and his expression was unreadable. Meanwhile, the four guests stared at Savi, wondering why her tone was so angry. "But then," continued Savi, looking only Odysseus in the eye, "they have no literature either. And neither do you." Odysseus smiled at the woman. Ada recognized the smile from when the man was carving flesh out of the flank of the grazing animal. Odysseus had bathed before dinner. Even his gray curly hair was freshly shampooed, but Ada still imagined his arms and hands and beard as they had been, streaked with blood, clotted with gore. It wasn't any of her business, but she thought it probably unwise for Savi to goad him so.
"The pre-literate meet the post-literate," continued Savi, opening her hand as if introducing Odysseus to the other four. Then she held up one finger. "Oh, I forgot our friend Harmon here. He is the Balzac and the Shakespeare of the current litter of old-style humanity. He reads at about the level of a six-year-old from the lost age, don't you, Harmon Ur? Lips move when you sound out the words, eh?"
"Yes," said Harmon, smiling slightly. "My lips do move when I read. I didn't know there was any other way to do it. And it took me more than 420s to reach that level of proficiency." To Ada, it appeared as if the 99-year-old knew he was being insulted but did not care, showing only interest in what Savi would say next. Ada cleared her throat. "What was that animal you killed today?" she asked Odysseus, her voice bright and brittle. "Not the terror birds, the other one."
"I just think of it as the floppy-nosed grazer," said Odysseus. "Want to try some?"
He reached back to the counter and lifted the platter of fire-darkened meat, holding it in front of Ada. Wanting to be polite, Ada took the smallest cut on the platter, handling it gingerly with utensils.
"I'll also take some," said Harmon. The platter went around. Hannah and Demon scowled at the meat, sniffed it, smiled politely, but didn't take any. When the platter came to Savi, she passed it on to Odysseus without a word. Ada nibbled the smallest bit she could slice. It was delicious, like steak, only stronger and richer. The wood smoke gave it a flavor different than any microwaved thing she had ever tasted. She cut a larger piece. Odysseus was eating with just a short, sharp knife he had brought to the table with him, slicing thin strips and chewing them from the end of the knife. Ada tried not to stare. "Makrachenia," said Savi between forkfuls of her salad and microwaved rice. Ada looked up, wondering if this was more of the woman's strange language ritual.
"Pardon me," said Demon.
"Makrachenia. That's the name of the animal that our Greek friend killed, and our two other friends are eating like there's no second course. They covered these South American plains a couple of million years ago, but went extinct before humankind showed up in South America. They were brought back by the Arnists during the crazy years after the Rubicon, before the post-humans put a stop to reintroducing extinct species helter-skelter. Once they had the Makrochenia back, though, some Arnist thought it would be clever to bring back Forus Shakos."
"Forus what?" said Demon.
"Forus Shakos, the terror birds. The Arnist geniuses forgot that those birds were the primary predator in South America for millions of years. At least until the Smilodonts wandered down from North America when the water level fell and the land bridge between the continents emerged.
Did you know that the Panamanian Isthmus is underwater again? The continents separate again?"
She looked around, obviously intoxicated, belligerent, and secure in the knowledge that none of them had any idea what she was talking about. Harmon sipped his wine.
"Do we want to know what a Smilodont is?"
Savi shrugged.
"Just a big fucking cat with big fucking saber-toothed teeth. They eat terror birds for lunch and pick their sabers with the leftover claws. The idiot Arnists did bring saber-tooths back, but not here, India. Anyone here know where that is, was, should be?
The post-humans ripped it free of Asia and broke it into a goddamned archipelago." The five looked at her.
"Thank you for reminding me," said Odysseus with his stilted accent, and stood and went to the counter. "Next course, terror bird."
He carried the big platter back to the table.
"I've been waiting to taste this delicacy for quite a while, but never had the time to hunt one until today. Who will join me?"
Everyone but Demon and Savi volunteered to try a slice. They all poured more wine for themselves. Outside, the thunderstorm had arrived with a vengeance, and flashes of lightning streaked around the bridge structure, illuminating the saddle and ruins far below, as well as the clouds and jagged peaks on either side. Ada, Harmon, and Hannah each tried a bite of the pale meat and then drank copious water and wine. Odysseus bit off slice after slice from the point of his knife.
"It reminds me of chicken," Ada said into the silence.
"Yes," said Hannah, "definitely chicken."
"Chicken with a strange, strong, bitter taste," said Harmon.
"Vulture," said Odysseus. "It reminds me of vulture."
He took another large bite, swallowed and grinned.
"If I cook terror bird again, I'll use lots of sauce."
Five of them ate their microwaved rice in silence while Odysseus enjoyed more helpings of his terror bird and macrochenia, washed down with huge draughts of wine. The conversational silence might have been uncomfortable if it had not been for the storm. The wind had come up. Lightning was almost continuous, illuminating the softly lit dining bubble in blasts of white light, and the thunder would have drowned out most conversation anyway. The green dining bubble seemed to sway ever so slightly when the wind howled and the four guests glanced at each other with barely concealed anxiety.
"It's all right," said Savi, no longer sounding angry or all that intoxicated, as if her earlier harsh words had vented some of the pressure from her bitterness.
"The paraglass does not conduct electricity, and we're firmly attached. As long as the bridge stands, we won't fall." Savi sipped the last of her wine and smiled without humor. "Of course, the bridge is older than God's teeth, so I can't guarantee it will remain standing." When the worst of the storm passed and Savi was offering coffee and chai heated in odd-looking glass containers, Anna said, "You promised to tell us how you got here, Odysseus, sir."
"You want me to sing to you of all my twists and turns driven time and again, of course,
"'In the days since my comrades and I plundered the hallowed heights of Pergamus?' "'He replied, voice soft. "'Yes,' said Hannah. "'I shall,' said Odysseus. "'But first I think Savior has some business to discuss with all of you.' "'They looked at the old woman and waited. "'I need your help,' said Savi. "'For centuries I have avoided exposure to your world, "'to the Voynix and the other watchers who wish me ill. "'But Odysseus is here for a reason.' And his ends serve my own. I ask if you would take him back to one of your homes where others can visit him and allow him to meet and speak with your friends. Ada, Harmon, Demon, and Hannah exchanged glances. Why doesn't he just fax wherever he wants? Asked Demon. Savi shook her head. Odysseus can no more fax than I can. That's silly, said Demon. Anyone can fax. Savi sighed and poured the last of the wine into her glass. Boy, she said, do you know what faxing is? Demon laughed. Of course, it's how you go from where you are to where you want to be. But how does it work? Asked Savi. Demon shook his head at the old woman's obtuseness. What do you mean, how does it work? It just works, like servitors or running water. You use a fax portal to go from one place to another, one fax node to the next. Harmon held up his hand. I think what Savi-Ur means is how does the machinery work that allows us to fax, Demon-Ur? I wondered that myself a few times, said Hannah. I understand how to build a furnace hearth that can melt metal, but how does one build a fax portal that sends us from here to there without having to go in between? Savi laughed. It doesn't, gentle children. Your fax portals don't send you anywhere. They destroy you, rip you atom from atom. They don't even send the atoms anywhere, just store them until they're needed by the next person faxing in. You don't go anywhere when you're faxed. You just die and allow another you to be built somewhere else. Odysseus drank his wine and watched the receding storm, apparently not interested in Savi's explanations. The other four stared at her. Why, said Ada, that's... "'Insane,' said Demon. Savi smiled. "'Yes.' Harmon cleared his throat and set down his coffee cup. "'If we are destroyed every time we fax, Savi-Ur, "'how is it that we remember everything when we arrive somewhere else?' "'He held up his right arm. "'And this small scar, I received it 7 years ago when I was 92. "'Normally these little problems are cleared up when we go to the firmary every 20, but... He stopped as if seeing the answer himself. Yes, said Savi. The machine minds behind the fax portals remember your little imperfections, just as they do your memories and personality's cell structure, sending the information, not you, but the information, from fax node to fax node, updating you and fixing your aging cells every 20 years, what you call your firmary visits. But why do you think you disappear on your 100th birthday, Harmoner? Why do they quit renewing you when you reach 100? And where will you go on your next birthday? Harmon said nothing, but Demon said, To the rings, you foolish woman. On the 520, we all ascend to the rings. To become post-humans, said Savi, barely avoiding a sneer, to ascend into heaven and sit at the right hand of... someone. Yes, said Hannah, but she made it sound like a question. No, said Savi, I don't know what happens to the memory patterns the Logosphere keeps of you until you turn 100. But I know they don't send the data to the rings. It may be stored, but I suspect it's just destroyed, scrambled. For the second time this long day, Ada felt as if she might faint. Still, she was the first to find her voice. Why can't you and Odysseus-Ur use the fax nodes, Savi-Ur? Or do you just choose not to? Choose not to be destroyed, to have the atoms of your body ripped apart like the bodies of the grazer and terror bird we were eating tonight. Ada dipped her fingers in her water glass and touched her fingertips to her cheek. Odysseus can't fax because the Logosphere has no record of him, Savi said softly. His first attempt to fax would be his last. Logosphere? Repeated Harmon. Savi shook her head again. That's a complicated topic, too complicated for an old woman who's had too much to drink today. But you will explain it soon? Pressed Harmon. I'll show you all tomorrow, said Savi.
before we go our different ways again. Ada caught Harmon's eye. He could barely contain his excitement. But this logosphere, whatever it is, said Hannah, has a record of you for the fax nodes, so you could fax. Savi showed her unhappy smile. Oh, yes, it remembers me from more than 1,400 years ago, when I faxed every day of my life. The logosphere is waiting for me like some invisible terror bird. It would recognize me instantly if I were to try one of your regular fax portals, but that would be my last attempt as well. I don't understand, said Hannah. Let's put all this technical double-talk aside for a while, said Savi, except that neither Odysseus here nor I can use your precious fax portals. And if I visited your wonderful society by flying there, it would be my life. Why? Asked Harmon. There's no violence in our world, other than the Turin drama, and none of us believe that is real. He looked pointedly at Odysseus, but the gray-haired man did not respond in any way. Savi sipped her wine. Just believe me when I say, believe me, that it is imperative that Odysseus be allowed to meet people, to speak to them, to be heard. If I were to fly you back, would one of you host him at your home for a few weeks? A month?
3 weeks,
interrupted Odysseus, sounding brusque, as if hearing himself spoken about as if he weren't there had irritated him.
No more.
All right, said Savi, 3 weeks. Will any of you offer 3 weeks of hospitality to this stranger in a strange land?
Wouldn't Odysseus be in danger in the same way you are? Asked Demon.
Odysseus, can take care of himself, said Savi. The four were silent a minute, trying to understand the request and the circumstances of the request. Finally, Harmon said, I'd like to host Odysseus, but I also want to visit this place you said might have spacecraft, Savi. My goal is to get to the rings, and as you pointed out, I'm approaching my final 20. I don't have any time to waste. I'd rather spend the time finding this drained sea where you say the post-humans kept something that can fly to the E and P rings. Perhaps if you showed me how to pilot your Sony. Savi rubbed her brow as if her head hurt. The Mediterranean Basin? You can't fly there, Harmon. You mean it's forbidden? No, said Savi. I mean you can't fly there. The Sonys and other flying machines won't work over the basin. She paused and looked around the table. But it's possible to hike or drive into the basin. I've tried and failed to go there over centuries, but I can lead you there. If one of your friends agrees to host Odysseus for 3 weeks.
I want to go with you and Harmon, said Ada.
So do I, said Demon. I want to see this whatchamacallit basin.
Harmon looked at the younger man in surprise.
To hell with it, said Demon. I'm no coward. I'll wager that I'm the only one here who's been eaten by an Allosaurus.
I'll drink to that, said Odysseus, and drained the last of his wine.
Savi looked at Hannah. That leaves you, my dear. I'd be happy to host Odysseus, said the young woman, but I don't fax that much or go to parties. I live with my mother, and she doesn't host groups that often either.
No, that won't work, I'm afraid, said Savi. Odysseus only has 3 weeks, and we need to start with a place that is well-known and where many can stay for weeks on end.
Actually, Ardis Hall would have been perfect, she looked at Ada. How do you know about Ardis Hall, Savi? Asked Ada.
For that matter, how do you know about Harmon's reading or anything about the world if you cannot walk among us or use the fax notes?
I do watch, said the older woman. I watch and wait and sometimes fly to places where I can mingle with you.
The Burning Man, said Hannah.
Yes, among other places, said Savi. She looked around the table and said, You all look exhausted. Why don't I show you to your room so you can get a good night's sleep? We'll continue the conversation in the morning. Just leave the dishes. I'll clear them and wash them later. The idea of picking up or washing dishes had never occurred to the guests. Once again, Ada looked around and felt the absence of servitors and voyniks. Ada wanted to protest this enforced bedtime. They'd not yet heard Odysseus tell his tale, but she looked at her friends. Hannah, hollow-eyed with fatigue, Demon drunk and barely able to keep his head up, Harmon's face showing his age, and felt the exhaustion working at her as well. It had been one hell of a day. It was time to sleep. Odysseus stayed at the table as Savi led the other four from the dining room down hallways, lighted only by the diminishing lightning, up a glass-covered escalator that wound around the Golden Gate Tower, and down a long corridor to a series of bubble rooms at the highest point on the North Tower. These sleeping rooms were not physically attached to the tower top, only to the glass corridor that had bridge steel as its south wall, and the sleeping cubbies themselves protruded precariously into space, like clusters of green grapes. Savi was offering them all separate sleep bubbles, and gestured Hannah into the first room along the corridor. The young woman hesitated at the entrance to the small space. Inside the sleeping cubby, even the floor was transparent, so that Hannah took one step forward and then hopped quickly backward into the relative solidity of the carpeted access hall. "It's perfectly safe," said Savi. "All right," said Hannah, and tried again. The bed was set against the far wall, and there was a privately partitioned toilet and sink space near the corridor wall, ensuring privacy from the viewpoint of the other sleep bubbles. But elsewhere, the curving walls and floor were so clear that you could look down 800 feet to the lightning-illuminated stones and hillside directly below. Hannah walked gingerly across the clear floor and settled gratefully onto the solid shape of the bed. The other three laughed and applauded. "If I have to go to the toilet in the night, I may not have the nerve to cross that floor again," said Hannah. "You'll get used to it, Hannah," said Savi. "You may close and open the door by voice command, and it is keyed to your voice only."
"Door, close," said Hannah.
The door irised, closed. Savi dropped them off one at a time in their cubbies, first Demon, who staggered to his bed with no apparent fear of the empty space under his feet. Then Harmon, who wished them both good night before ordering his door closed, then Ada. "Sleep well, my dear," said Savi. "The sunrises here are rather beautiful, and I hope you enjoy the view in the morning. I shall see you at breakfast." There were fresh silk sleeping clothes set out on her bed. Ada went into the toilet area, took a quick hot shower, dried her hair, left her clothes on the counter next to the sink, dressed in the silk sleeping gown, and returned to the bed. Once under the covers, she turned her face to the wall and looked out at the mountain peaks and cloud tops. The thunderstorm had passed on to the east now. The lightning illuminated the receding clouds from within, and now the nearby peaks and grassy saddle were illuminated by moonlight. Ada looked down at the roadway and stone ruins so far below. What had Odysseus said about that place? That it was inhabited only by jaguars, chipmunks, and ghosts? Looking at the ancient pale gray stones in the moonlight, Ada almost believed in the ghosts. There came a soft tapping at her door. Ada slipped from the bed and tiptoed across the cold floor, setting her fingertips against the irised metal. "Who is it?"
"Armin."
Ada's heart thudded in her chest. She had been hoping, silently wishing, that Harmon would join her tonight. "Door open," she whispered, stepping back, noting in the wall's reflection how milky her arms and thin gown looked in the moonlight. Harmon stepped just inside and paused as Ada whispered the door closed again. Harmon was wearing only blue silk sleep garb. She waited for him to embrace her, to lift her in his arms and carry her to the soft bed against the clear curved wall. What would it be like, she wondered, to make love as if one were floating above these clouds, these mountains? "I needed to talk to you," Harmon said softly. Ada nodded. "I think it's important that Odysseus be in the right place the next few weeks," he said. "And I don't think that Hannah's mother's cubby is the right place." Feeling foolish, Ada folded her arms across her breasts. She imagined that she could feel the cold night air of the high mountains through the glass under her feet. "You don't know what Odysseus wants to do or why," she whispered. "No. But if he's really Odysseus, it may be very important. And Savi's right, Ardis Hall is the perfect place for him to meet people." Ada felt anger coil in her. Who was this man to tell her what to do? "If you think it's so important that he be hosted somewhere," she said, "why don't you invite him to your home as your guest?" "I don't have a home," said Harmon. Ada blinked at this, trying to understand. She couldn't. Everyone had a home. I've been traveling for many years, said Harmon. I own only what I carry, except for the books I've collected, which I store in an empty cubby in Paris Crater. Ada opened her mouth to speak, but could think of nothing to say. Harmon took a step closer, so close that Ada could smell the mail and soap scent of him. He had also showered before coming to her room. Will we make love after this conversation? Thought Ada, feeling her anger slip away as quickly as it came. I need to go to the Mediterranean basin with Savi, said Harmon. I've been hunting for a way to get to the E and P rings for more than 60 years, Ada. The beast's so close. Well, I have to go. Ada felt the anger flare again. But I want to go with you. I want to see this basin. Find a spaceship. Go to the rings. It's why I've helped you the last few weeks. I know, whispered Harmon. He touched her arm, and I want you to go with me. But this thing with Odysseus may be important. I know, but... And Hannah just doesn't know that many people. Or have the space to host visitors. I know, but... And Artist Hall would be perfect, whispered Harmon. He released his soft hold on Ada's arm, but still held her in the grip of his gaze. Ada was aware of the stars beyond the clear curved ceiling above them. I know Artist Hall would be perfect, said Ada. She felt sad and torn between imperatives and people. But we don't even know what this Odysseus wants or who he really is. True, whispered Harmon, but the best way to find out would be for you to host him while I hunt for a spaceship in the Mediterranean basin. I promise you that if I find one that can get us to the rings, I'll come get you before I go there. Ada hesitated before speaking again. Her face was raised slightly toward Harmon's, and she had the feeling that if they did not speak, he would kiss her. Suddenly, lightning flashed and thunder from the receding storm shook the green glass structure. All right, Ada whispered. I'll host Odysseus and have Hannah as my helper at Artis Hall for 3 weeks, but only if you promise to take me to the rings if you find a way to get there. I promise, said Harmon. He did kiss her then, but only on the cheek, and only the way her father might have, Ada thought, if she had ever known her father. Harmon turned as if leaving, but before Ada could command the door to Iris open, he turned back toward her. What do you think of Odysseus? He asked. What do you mean? You mean, do I think he's really Odysseus? Ada was confused by the question. No, I mean, what do you think of him? Are you interested in the man? Interested in his story, you mean? Said Ada. He's intriguing. But I'll have to hear what he says before I decide whether he's telling the truth about things. No, I... Harmon stopped and rubbed his chin. He seemed embarrassed. I mean, do you find him interesting? Are you attracted to him? Ada had to laugh. Somewhere to the east, the receding thunder echoed the sound. You idiot, she said at last, and, waiting no longer, walked to Harmon, put her arms around him, and kissed him on the lips. Harmon responded passively for a few seconds, and then embraced her and kissed her back. Through the thin silk that separated them, Ada could feel his excitement rise. Moonlight flowed over the skin of their faces and arms like spilled white milk. Suddenly, a powerful gust of wind struck the bridge and the bubble of the sleeping cubby swayed underfoot. Harmon lifted Ada and carried her to the bed.
20. Letitia's Sea on Mars.
I think it's Falstaff that made me fall out of love with the bard.
What's that? Said Monmouth over the hardline. He was preoccupied driving the dying submersible toward the still out-of-sight coastline at a weakening 8 knots, trying to keep the ship functions online, watching the skies for enemy chariots through the periscope buoy, and generally brooding about the improbability of their continued survival. Orfu had been silent down there in the Dark Lady's hold for more than 2 hours. Now this. What was that about Falstaff? Said Monmouth.
Well, I was just saying that it was Falstaff that drove me away from Shakespeare and toward Proust, said Orfu.
I would have thought that you'd love Falstaff, said Monmouth. He's so funny.
I did love Falstaff, said Orfu. Hell, I identified with Falstaff. I wanted to be Falstaff. For a while, I thought I looked like Falstaff.
Monmouth tried to imagine this. He couldn't. He returned his attention to the ship's functions and perusing the periscope. What made you change your mind? He asked.
Do you remember the scene in Henry IV, Part 1, where Falstaff finds the body of Henry Percy Hotspur on the battlefield?
Yes, said Monmouth.
The periscope and radar showed the skies clear of chariots. He had been forced to shut down the failing reactor during the night, and battery reserves were down to 4%, giving them only 6 knots now, and the power was still dropping. Monmouth knew that he'd have to take the Dark Lady up to the surface again soon. Every time they surfaced, he brought in Martian air for his own survival, storing it in his Envirocrash and breathing it until it got foul, funneling all the ship-produced air down to Orfu. The submersible had never been designed to open itself to European atmosphere, and he'd had to override a dozen safety protocols to let the Martian air in. Falstaff stabs Hotspur's corpse in the thigh just to make sure he's dead, said Orfu. Then carries Hotspur's body on his back, trying to take credit for killing him.
Right, said Monmouth.
The MPS said that they were within 30 kilometers of the coast, but there was no sign of it in the periscope, and he didn't want to direct the radar toward land. He prepared to blow the ballast tanks and surface again, but had the dive planes ready for an emergency dive if anything showed on the radar. The better part of valor is discretion, in which better part I have saved my life, he quoted. All the Shakespearean commentary I read, Bloom, Goddard, Bradley, Morgan, Hazlitt, and even Emerson, says that Falstaff may be one of the greatest characters Shakespeare ever created.
Yes,
said Orfu, and stayed silent a minute while the submersible shook and rumbled to the ballast tanks being blown. When the ship was silent again except for the ocean rushing over the hull, he said,
But I find Falstaff despicable.
Despicable?
The sub broke the surface. It was just after dawn and the sun, so much larger than the point star sun Monmouth had grown up with on Europa, was just breaking free of the horizon. He opened the vents and breathed in fresh salt air.
We're in cunning but in craft, we're in crafty but in villainy, we're in villainous but in all things, said Orfu.
But Prince Hal was joking when he said that.
Monmouth decided to run on the surface. It was far more dangerous. Radar had picked up a flying chariot every hour or two while they were submerged. But they could make 8 knots on the surface and stretch out their dwindling power reserves.
Was he? Said Orfu. It rejects the old blowhard in Henry IV, Part II.
And Falstaff dies from it, said Monmouth, breathing in the clean air and thinking of Orfu down in the black and flooded hold, connected to life only by the O2 line and the intercom.
The first time they had surfaced, Monmouth had realized it would be impossible to get the big Ionian out of the hold until they reached land.
The king has killed his heart, he said, quoting Hostess quickly.
I've decided he deserved to be rejected, said Orfu. When he was ordered to recruit soldiers for the war with Percy, Falstaff took bribes to let the good ones off and recruited only losers. Men he called food for powder.
Feeling the Dark Lady surging ahead faster through the low waves, Monmouth kept monitoring the sonar, radar, and periscope.
Everyone says that Falstaff is a much more interesting character than Hal, he said. Funny, realistic, anti-military, witty. Hazlitt wrote that the bliss of freedom gained in humor is the essence of Falstaff.
Yes, said Orfu. But what kind of freedom is it? The freedom to mock everything, the freedom to be a thief and a coward?
Sir John was a knight, said Monmouth. Suddenly his attention focused on what Orfu was saying, Orfu the cynic and humorous commentator on the folly of Moravec existence.
You sound more like Koras III, he said. This made Orfu rumble.
I'll never be a warrior.
Was Koras a warrior? Do you think he killed Moravec during his mission to the Belt?
Monmouth was curious.
We'll never know what happened in the Belt, said Orfu. And I doubt that Koras had any more eagerness to fight than do the rest of us peaceable Moravec. But he was trained to leadership and duty, things that Falstaff mocked even in his beloved Prince Hal.
And you're thinking that we've been called to duty here, said Monmouth. There was a haze to the south.
Something like that.
And you think you might need to be more Hotspur than Falstaff?
Orfu Vile rumbled again. It may be too late for that. I wasted time, and now doth time waste me.
That's not Falstaff.
Richard II, came the voice from the hold.
You think you're too old for what lies ahead? Asked Monmouth, wondering himself what might lie ahead.
Well, I feel a little old, sans eyes, sans legs, sans hands, sans teeth, and sans shell, said the Ionian.
You never had teeth, said Monmouth. Koras's mission had been to carry out reconnaissance near the big volcano Olympus, and to deliver the device in the cargo bay as close to the summit of Olympus as possible. But the Dark Lady was close to death, and Orfu might also be dying. Even if Orfu survived, he would not be able to land. How could Monmouth possibly deliver the device across more than 3,000 kilometers of landmass while keeping himself and his friend from being detected and destroyed by the chariot people? Worry about that when you get the lady to land and Orfu out of the hold, he thought. One thing at a time. The blue sky was empty of threat, but he felt terribly exposed as the submersible continued to wallow southward through the waves. To Orfu he said, "Does your friend Proust have any advice?"
Orfu cleared his throat with a rumble. "Old age hath yet his honor and his toil. Death closes all, but something ere the end, some work of noble note may yet be done. 'Tis not too late to seek a newer world. Though much is taken, much abides. And though we are not now that strength which in old days moved earth and heaven, that which we are, we are. One equal temper of heroic hearts, made weak in time and fate, but strong in will to strive, to seek, and not to yield.'"
"You can't convince me that's Proust," said Monmouth. The haze to the south was resolving itself.
"No," said Orfu, "that's Tennyson's Ulysses."
"Who's Ulysses?"
"Odysseus."
"Who's Odysseus?" There was a shocked silence. Finally, Orfu said,
"Ah, my friend, this gap in your otherwise excellent education calls out for repair. We may well need to know as much as we can about..."
"Wait," said Monmouth, and a minute later, "wait."
"What is it?"
"Land," said Monmouth. "I can see land."
"Anything else? Any details?"
"I'm changing magnification," said Monmouth.
Orfu waited, but finally said, "And?"
"The stone faces," said Monmouth. "I see the stone faces. On the cliff tops, mostly, stretching as far to the east as I can see."
"Just to the east? None to the west?"
"No. The line of faces ends almost where we'd reached land. I can see movement there, hundreds of people or things moving along the cliffs and beach."
"We'd better dive," said Orfu. "Wait for dark before we make landfall. Find an ocean cave or something where you can bring the lady in unseen where..."
"Too late," said Monmouth. "The ship doesn't have more than 40 minutes of life support and propulsion left in her. Besides, the shapes, the people, have given up their work moving the stone faces west. They're coming down to the beach by the hundreds. They've seen us." 21. Ilium. I could tell you what it's like to make love to Helen of Troy, but I won't. And not just because it would be totally ungentlemanly of me to do so. The details are just not part of my story here, but I can say truthfully that if the vengeful muse or maddened Aphrodite had found me a moment after Helen and I ended our first bout of lovemaking, say, a minute after we rolled apart on the sweat-moistened sheets to catch our breath and feel the cool breeze coming in ahead of the storm, and if the muse and the goddess had crashed in and killed me then, I can tell you without fear of contradiction that the short second life of Thomas Hockenberry would have been a happy one. And at least it would have ended on a high note. A minute after that instant of perfection, the woman was holding a dagger to my belly. "Who are you?" demanded Helen.
"I'm your..."
I began and stopped. Something in Helen's eyes made me abort my lie about being Paris before I could vocalize it. "If you say you are my new husband, I will have to sink this blade into your bowels," she said evenly. "If you are a god, that shouldn't matter, but if you aren't..." "I'm not," I managed. The point of the knife was close enough to draw blood from the skin above my belly. Where did this knife come from? Had it been in the cushions while we were making love? "If you aren't a god, how have you taken Paris's shape?" I realized that this was Helen of Troy, the mortal daughter of Zeus, a woman who lived in a universe where gods and goddesses had sex with mortals all the time. A world where shape-changers, divine and otherwise, walked among mere humans. A world where the concept of cause and effect had completely different meanings. I said, "The gods gave me the ability to change appearances.
"Who are you?" she asked. "What are you?" She did not seem angry, nor even especially shocked. Her voice was calm, her beautiful features undistorted by fear or fury. But the blade was steady against my belly. The woman wanted an answer. "My name is Thomas Hockenberry," I said. "I'm a Skolik." I knew that none of this would make sense. My name sounded strange, even to me, hard-edged in the smoother tones of their ancient language. "Thomas Hockenberry," she mouthed. "It sounds Persian." No, I said Dutch and German and Irish, actually. I saw Helen frown and knew I was not only not making sense to her with these words, but was sounding actively deranged. "Put on a robe," she said. "We will talk on the terrace." Helen's large bedroom had terraces on both sides, one looking down into the courtyard, the other looking out south and east over the city. My levitation harness and other gear, except for the QT medallion and morphing bracelet I had worn to bed, were hidden behind the curtain on the courtyard terrace. Helen led me to the outside terrace. We each wore thin robes. Helen kept her short, sharp knife in her hand as we stood at the railing in the reflected light from the city and from the occasional storm flash. "Are you a god?" she asked. I almost answered yes. It would be the easiest way to talk her out of putting that blade in my belly, but had the sudden, inexplicable, overwhelming urge to tell the truth for a change. "No," I said, "I'm not a god." She nodded. "I knew you were not a god. I would have gutted you like a fish if you had lied to me about that." She smiled grimly. "You don't make love like a god." "Well," I thought, but there was nothing else to say to that. "How is it," she asked, "that you can take the shape and form of Paris?" "The gods have given me the ability to do so," I said. "Why?" The tip of the dagger blade was only inches from my bare skin through the robe. I shrugged, but then realizing that shrugs weren't used by the ancients, I said, "They lent me this ability for their own purposes. I serve them, I watch the battle and report to them. It helps that I can take the shape of other men." Helen did not seem surprised by this. "Where is my Trojan lover? What have you done to the real Paris?" "He's well," I said. "When I abandon this likeness, he will return to what he was doing when I morphed, when I took his shape." "Where will he be?" asked Helen. I thought this was a slightly strange question. "Wherever he would have been if I hadn't borrowed his form," I said at last. "I think he'd just left the city to join Hector for tomorrow's fighting. Actually, when I morph out of Paris's form, Paris will be exactly where he would have been if he'd continued on during the time I had his identity. Sleeping in a tent, perhaps, or in the midst of battle, or shagging one of the slave girls in Hector's war camp." But this was too difficult to explain to Helen. I didn't think she'd appreciate a discourse on probability wave functions and quantum temporal simultaneity. I couldn't explain why it was that neither Paris nor those around him wouldn't necessarily notice his absence, or how it was that events might reconnect to the Iliad as if I hadn't interrupted the probability wave collapse of that temporal line. Quantum continuity might be sewn up as soon as I canceled the morph function. Shit, I didn't understand any of this. "Leave this swarm," commanded Helen. "Show me your true shape." "My lady, if I..." I began to protest, but her hand moved quickly. The blade cut through silk and skin, and I felt the blood flow on my abdomen. Showing her that my right hand was going to move very, very slowly, I opened the glowing functions and touched the icon on the morphing bracelet. I was Thomas Hockenberry, again shorter, thinner, gawkier, with my slightly myopic gaze and thinning hair. Helen blinked once and swung the dagger up fast, faster than I thought any person could move. I heard the ripping and tearing, but it wasn't my stomach muscles she'd sliced open, only the tie of the robe and the silken material itself. "Don't move," she whispered. Helen of Troy flung my robe open, using her free hand to slide it off my shoulders. I stood naked and pale in front of this formidable woman. If a dictionary ever needed a perfect definition of pathetic, a photograph of this moment would suffice. "You may put the robe back on," she said after a minute. I tugged it back up. The sash was torn, so I held it together with my hand. She seemed to be thinking. For several minutes we stood there on the terrace in silence. Even as late as it was, the towers of Ilium glowed from torchlight. Watchfires flickered along the ramparts on the distant walls. Farther to the south, beyond the Sian Gate, the corpse fires burned. To the southwest, lightning flashed in the towering storm clouds,
There were no stars visible, and the air smelled of the rain coming from the direction of Mount Ida. "How did you know I was not Paris?" I asked at last. Helen blinked out of her reverie and gave a small smile. A woman may forget the color of her lover's eyes, the tone of his voice, even the details of his smile or form, but she cannot forget how her husband fucks. It was my turn to blink in surprise, and not just at Helen's vulgar speech. Homer had literally sung the praises of Paris's appearance, comparing him to a stallion full-fed at the manger, when describing Paris's rush to join Hector outside the city this very night. Sure in his racing stride, his head flung back, his mane streaming over his shoulders, sure and sleek in his glory. Paris was, in the teenager's parlance of my previous life, a hunk. And while I had been in Helen's bed, I had owned Paris's streaming hair, his sun-bronzed body, his washboard belly, his oiled muscles, his... "Your penis is larger," said Helen. I blinked again, twice this time. She had not used the word penis, of course. Latin was not yet a real language, and the Greek word she had chosen was slang closer to cock. But that made no sense. When we were making love, I'd had Paris's penis. "No, that wasn't how I knew you were not my lover," said Helen. She seemed to be reading my mind. "That is just my observation." "Then how?" "Yes," said Helen. "It was how you bedded me, Hockenberry." I had nothing to say to this, and could not have spoken clearly if I'd had anything to say. Helen smiled again. "Paris first had met me not in Sparta, where he won me, nor in Ilium, where he brought me, but on the little island of Crane, on the way here." There was no island that I knew of named Crane, and the word merely meant rocky in ancient Greek. So I took it to mean that Paris had interrupted their voyage to put into some small rocky, unnamed island to have his way with Helen without the watching presence of the ship's crew, which would mean that Paris was impatient. "So were you, Hockenberry," came the voice of something not totally unlike my conscience. Too late for a conscience. "He's had me, and I've had him hundreds of times since then," Helen said softly, "but never like tonight. Never like tonight." I was a dither with confusion and smug with pride. Was this good? Was this a compliment? No, wait. That's absurd. Homer sings of Paris as nearly godlike in his physical beauty and charm. A great lover, irresistible to women and goddesses alike, which must mean that Helen only meant... "You," she said, interrupting my confused thoughts. "You were... Ernest." "Ernest." I clutched the robe tighter and looked toward the coming storm to hide my embarrassment. "Ernest." "Sincere," she said, "very sincere." If she didn't shut up soon and quit hunting for synonyms for pathetic, I thought I might wrestle the dagger away from her and cut my own throat with it. "Did the gods send you here to me?" she asked. I considered lying again. Certainly not even this strong-willed woman would gut someone on an errand from the gods. But again I chose not to lie. Helen of Troy seemed almost telepathic in her ability to read me, and telling the truth for a change felt good. "No," I said, "no one sent me."
"You came here just because you wanted to bed me?"
Well, at least she hadn't used the F-word again. "Yes," I said, "I mean, no." She looked at me. Somewhere in the city a man laughed loudly, then a woman did the same. Ilium never slept. "I mean, I was lonely," I said. "I've been here for the whole war by myself with no one to talk to, no one to touch." "You touched me enough," said Helen. I couldn't tell from her tone if it was sarcasm or an accusation. "Yes," I said.
"Are you married, Hockenberry?"
"Yes." "No." I shook my head again. I must sound like a total idiot to Helen. "I believe I was married," I said, "but if I was, my wife is dead."
"You believe you were married?"
"The gods brought me to Mount Olympus across time and space," I said, knowing she would not understand, but not caring. "I believe... I died in my other life, and they somehow brought me back, but they did not return all my memory to me. Images come and go from my real life, my former life, like dreams."
"I understand," said Helen.
I realized from her tone that somehow, amazingly, she did understand.
"Is there a particular god or goddess you serve, Hockenberry?"
"I report to one of the muses," I said, "but I learned just yesterday that Aphrodite controls my fate." Helen looked up in surprise.
"And so has she controlled mine," she said softly.
"Just yesterday, when the goddess saved Paris from Menelaus' fury and brought him back here to our bed,
Aphrodite ordered me to go to him. When I protested, she flew into a rage and threatened to make me the butt of hard, withering hate, her words, of both Trojans and Achaeans.
The goddess of love, I said softly.
The goddess of lust, said Helen.
And I know much about lust, Huckenberry.
Again, I didn't know what to say. My mother was named Leda, called the Daughter of Night, she said in conversational tones, and Zeus came to her and fucked her while he was in the shape of a swan, a huge horny swan. There was a mural in my home showing my two older brothers and an altar to Zeus and me as an egg, waiting to be hatched. I couldn't help it. I barked a laugh. Then my stomach muscles clenched, waiting for the dagger's blade to rip through it. Instead, Helen smiled broadly. Yes, she said. I know about abductions and being a pawn of the gods, Huckenberry. Yes, I said, when Paris came to Sparta. No, interrupted Helen. When I was 11, Huckenberry, I was carried off, abducted from the temple of Artemis Orthia by Theseus, uniter of the Attica communities into the city of Athens. Theseus made me pregnant. I bore him a girl child, Iphigenia, whom I could not look upon with love, and handed over to Clytemnestra, to raise with her husband Agamemnon as their own. I was rescued from this marriage by my brothers and returned to Sparta. Theseus then went off with Hercules in his war against the Amazons, where he took time to invade Hell, marry an Amazon warrior, and explore the labyrinth of the Minotaur in Crete. My head was spinning. Every one of these Greeks and Trojans and gods had a story, and had to tell it at the drop of a hat. But what did this have to do with... I know about lust, Huckenberry, said Helen. The great King Menelaus claimed me as his bride, even though such men love virgins, love their bloodlines more than life, even though I was soiled goods in a man's world that loves its virgins so. And then Paris, spurred on by Aphrodite, came to abduct me again, to take me to Troy, to be his prize. Helen stopped the recitation and seemed to be studying me. I could think of nothing to say. There was a bottomless depth of bitterness between her cool, ironic words. No, not bitterness, I realized, looking into her eyes. Sadness. A terrible, tired sadness. Huckenberry, continued Helen, do you think I am the most beautiful woman in the world? Did you come here to abduct me? No, I did not come here to abduct you. I have nowhere to take you. My own days are numbered by the wrath of the gods. I have betrayed my muse and her boss, Aphrodite, and when Aphrodite heals from the wounds Diomedes inflicted on her yesterday, she will wipe me off the face of the earth as sure as we're standing here.
Yes? Said Helen.
Yes.
Come to bed, Huckenberry.
I wake in the gray hour before dawn, having slept only a few hours after our last two bouts of lovemaking, but feeling perfectly rested. My back is to Helen, but somehow I know that she is also lying awake on this large bed with its elaborately carved posts.
Huckenberry?
Yes?
How do you serve Aphrodite and the other gods?
I think about this a minute and then roll over. The most beautiful woman in the world is lying there in the dim light, propping herself up on one elbow. Her long dark hair, mussed by our lovemaking, flowing around her naked shoulder and arm, with her eyes, pupils wide and dark, intent on mine.
How do you mean, I ask, although I know. Why did the gods bring you across time and space, as you say, to serve them? What do you know that they need?
I close my eyes for a moment. How can I possibly explain to her? It will be madness if I answer honestly, but, as I admitted earlier, I'm terribly tired of lying. I know something about the war going on, I say. I know some of the events that will happen, might happen.
You serve an oracle?
No.
You are a prophet, then? A priest to whom one of the gods has given such vision?
No.
Then I don't understand, says Helen. I shift on my side and sit up, moving cushions to be more comfortable. It is in the place whence I came, I whisper. There is a song, a poem about this war. It's called the Iliad. So far, the events of the actual war resemble those sung about in this song.
You speak as if this siege and this war were already an old tale in the land you came from, says Helen. As if all this has already occurred.
Don't admit this to her. It would be folly. Yes, I say. That is the truth. You are one of the fates, she says. No, I'm just a man. Helen smiles with wicked amusement. She touches the valley between her breasts where I had climaxed just a few hours earlier. I know that, Hockenberry. I blush, rub my cheeks, and feel the stubble there. No shaving in the Skolik barracks for me this morning. Why bother? You only have hours to live. Will you answer my questions about the future? She asks, her voice terribly soft. It would be madness to do so. I don't really know your future, I say disingenuously. Only the details of this song, and there have been many discrepancies between it and the actual events. Will you answer my questions about the future? She sets her hand on my chest. Yes, I say. Is Ilium doomed? Helen's voice is steady, calm, soft. Yes. Will it be taken by strength or stealth? For God's sake, you can't tell her that, I think. By stealth, I say. Helen actually smiles. Odysseus, she murmurs. I say nothing. I tell myself that perhaps if I give no details, these revelations will not affect events. Will Paris be killed before Troy falls? She asks. Yes. By Achilles' hand? No details, clamors my conscience. No, I say, fuck it. And the noble Hector? Death, I say, feeling like some vicious hanging judge. By Achilles' hand? Yes. And Achilles, will he go home from this war alive? No. His fate is sealed as soon as he slays Hector, and he has known this all along. Knew it from a prophecy he has carried with him like a cancer for years. Long life or glory, Homer said that it was, is, will be the decision he must make. But the prophecy goes if he chooses long life, he will be known only as a man, not as the demigod he will become if he kills Hector in combat. But he has a choice. The future is not sealed. And King Priam? Death, I say, my whisper hoarse. Slaughtered in his own palace, in his private temple to Zeus, hacked to bloody bits like a heifer being sacrificed to the gods. And Hector's little boy, Scamandrius, whom the people call Astyanax. Death, I say. I close my eyes against the image of Pyrrhus, flinging the screaming infant down from the wall. And Andromache? Helen whispers, Hector's wife? A slave, I say. If Helen keeps up this litany of questions, I'm pretty sure I'll go crazy. It was all right from a distance, from a Skolik's disinterested observer's stance. But now I'm talking about people I have known and met and slept with. It strikes me that Helen has not asked about her own fate. Perhaps she never will. And will I die with Ilium? She asks, her voice still calm. I take a breath. No. But Menelaus will find me? Yes. I feel like one of those black, crazy eight tell-your-fortune toys that were popular when I was a kid. Why hadn't I answered her like that black ball would have? That would be more like the oracle at Delphi. The future is cloudy, or ask again. Am I showing off for this woman? It's too late now. Menelaus finds me but does not kill me. I survive his anger? Yes. I remember Odysseus telling of this in the Odyssey. Menelaus finding Helen hiding in Deiphobus' quarters in the great royal palace, near the shrine of the Palladian, and of the cuckolded husband throwing himself upon her, sword drawn, pulling, intending to kill this beautiful woman. Helen will uncover her breasts to her husband, as if inviting the blow, as if willing it, and then Menelaus will drop his sword and kiss her. It's not clear whether Deiphobus, one of the sons of Priam, is killed by Menelaus before this or after him. But he takes me back to Sparta, whispers Helen. Paris dead, Hector dead, all the great warriors of Ilium dead or put to the sword, all the great women of Troy dead or dragged off to slavery. The city itself burned, its wall breached, its towers dragged down and broken up, the earth salted so that nothing will ever grow here again. But I live, and am taken back to Sparta by Menelaus? Something like that, I say, hearing how lame it sounds.
Helen rolls out of bed, stands, and walks naked to the courtyard terrace. For a minute, I forget my role as Cassandra and just gaze in something like awe at her dark hair tumbling down her back, at her perfect buttocks and at her strong legs. She stands naked at the railing, not turning back my way, as she says, "And what about you, Hockenberry? Have the fates told you your own destiny through this song of theirs?" "No," I confess. "I'm not important enough to be included in the poem, but I'm pretty sure I will die today." She turns. I expect Helen to be weeping after all I've told her, if she believes me, but she's smiling slightly. "Only pretty sure?" "Yes." "You will die because of Aphrodite's wrath?" "Yes." "I've felt that wrath, Hockenberry. If she takes a whim to kill you, she will." "Well, that's encouraging." I say nothing for a while. There is a drone from the open terrace doorways on the city side. "What's that?" I ask. "The Trojan women are still entreating Athena for mercy and divine protection, chanting and sacrificing at her temple as Hector ordered," says Helen. She turns away from me again and stares down into the interior courtyard, as if trying to find that solitary singing bird. "Too late for Athena's mercy," I think. Then, without thinking about it, I say, "Aphrodite wants me to kill Athena. She's given me the Hades helmet and other tools so I can do just that." Helen's head snaps around, and even in the dim light I can see the expression of shock on her face. The pallor. It's as if she has finally reacted to all my terrible oracle news. Naked, she comes back and sits on the edge of the bed where I am propped up on one elbow. "Did you say kill Athena?" she whispers, voice lower than at any time since we began speaking. I nod. "Can the gods be killed then?" asks Helen, her voice so soft I can barely hear it from a foot away. "I think they can," I say. "Only yesterday I heard Zeus tell Ares that gods could die." Then I tell her about Aphrodite and Ares, their wounds, the strange place where they are healing. I explain how Aphrodite will emerge from that vat today sometime, how it's possible she already has, since Olympus is on the same day-night schedule as Ilium, and it's already tomorrow there as well. "You're able to travel to Olympus?" she whispers. Helen appears to be lost in thought. Her expression has slowly melted from shock to... "What? Travel back and forth from Ilium to Olympus whenever you please?" she asks. I hesitate here. I know I've told too much already. What if this Helen is merely my muse in morphed form? I know she isn't. Don't ask me how I know, and to hell with it if she is. "Yes," I say, also whispering now, although the household is not coming awake yet. "I can go to Olympus when I want and stay there unseen by the gods. Except for the single bird deluded to think it's almost dawn, the city and the palace are eerily silent. There are guards at the front entrance, I know. But I cannot hear their shuffle of their sandals or the scrape of their spear butts on stone. The streets of Ilium, never totally silent, seem hushed now. Even the women's chanting from the temple of Athena has ceased." "Did Aphrodite give you the means to kill Athena, Hockenberry? Some weapon of the gods?" "No." I don't tell her about the Hades helmet of death or the QT medallion or my taser baton. None of these things could kill a goddess. Suddenly that short dagger is in her hand again, inches from my skin. Where does she keep that thing? How does she make it appear that way? We both have our little secrets, I guess. The dagger moves closer. "If I kill you now," whispers Helen, "will it change the song of Ilium, you know? Change the future? This future?" "This isn't the time to be honest, Tommy boy," warns the sane part of my brain. "But I speak the truth anyway." "I don't know," I say. "I don't see how it can. If it's my fate to die today, I suppose it doesn't matter whether it's by your hand or Aphrodite's. Anyway, I'm not an actor in this drama, only an observer." Helen nods, but still appears distracted, as if her question about my death were of little consequence either way. She lifts the dagger until its point is almost touching the firm white flesh under her chin. "If I take my own life right now, will it change the song?" she asks. "I don't see how it will save Ilium or change the outcome of the war," I answer. This isn't completely true.
Helen is a central figure in Homer's Iliad, and I have no idea whether the Greeks would stay to finish the fight if she kills herself. What would they be fighting for with Helen dead? Glory, honor, plunder. But then again, with Helen removed as the prize for Agamemnon and Menelaus, and Achilles still sulking in his tent, would mere plunder be enough to keep the tens and tens of thousands of other Achaeans in the fight? They've been plundering islands and Trojan coastal cities for almost a decade now. Perhaps they've had enough, and are looking for an excuse. Isn't that why Menelaus accepted the one-on-one combat with Paris to decide it all, before Aphrodite whisked Paris away? Back to this bed. Helen and Paris having sex in this bed mere hours ago. Perhaps Helen's suicide would end the war. She lowers the dagger. I've thought of this self-murder for 10 years, Hakenberry. But I have too much lust to live and too little fondness for death, even though I deserve to die. You don't deserve to die, I say. She smiles. Does Hector deserve to die? Does his baby? Does lordly Priam, the most generous of fathers to me? Do all those people you hear awakening out there in the city deserve to die? Do even the warriors, Achilles and all the rest, who have already gone down to cold Hades, deserve to die because of one fickle woman who chose passion and vanity and abduction over fidelity? And what about all the thousands of Trojan women who have served their gods and husbands well, but who will be torn from their homes and children and be sold into slavery because of me? Do they deserve such a fate, Hakenberry, just because I choose to live? You don't deserve to die, I say stubbornly. The scent of her is still on my skin, my fingers, and in my hair. All right, says Helen, and slides the dagger under the mattress. Then will you help me live and stay free? Will you help stop this war, or at least change its outcome? What do you mean? I'm suddenly wary. I have no interest in trying to help the Trojans win this battle, and I couldn't do it if I tried. Too many forces are in play here, not to mention the gods. Helen, I say. I was serious about not having any time left. Aphrodite will be free of her recovery vat today, and while I might hide for a while from the other gods, she has a way she can find me when she wants to. Even if she doesn't kill me right away for disobeying her, I won't be free to act in the short time I have left as a skolic. Helen slides the sheet off my lower body. The light is coming up now, and I can see her better than any time since I watched her in her bath the night before. She swings her leg up and straddles me, one hand flat on my chest while her other hand goes lower, finding encouraging. Listen to me, she says, looking down over her breasts at me. If you are going to change our fates, you must find the fulcrum. I take this as an invitation and try to move into her. No, not yet, she whispers. Listen to me, Hakenberry. If you're going to change our fates, you must find the fulcrum. And I don't mean what you're doing now. It's difficult, but I pause long enough to listen. End of side.